Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headline: Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman calls on a U.S. federal court to throw out a lawsuit which accuses him of trying to have an ex-intelligence official assassinated. The presidents of Iran and Afghanistan inaugurate a major railway project aimed at expanding trade exchanges between the two neighbors. And also in our headlines, the U.K. and the EU agree to decide by Sunday whether their Brexit talks are worth continuing as the two sides remain far apart on a future trade deal. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story: Saudi Arabia's crown prince and de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman has asked a U.S. federal court to drop a lawsuit that accuses him of sending a hit squad to kill a former intelligence official. In the lawsuit, Saad al-Jabri said the assassination attempt took place in Canada, where he fled 3 years ago. Jabari said he was a target because of his ties with bin Salman's rival and former security chief Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. MBS's lawyer said that the suit did not provide evidence of claim. The case was filed under laws which allow foreign nationals to file complaints in the U.S. over alleged human rights abuses. The plaintiff said bin Salman wanted to kill and dismember him in the same way journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in Istanbul. In October last year, Khashoggi's murder sparked an international outcry, with the CIA concluding that MBS had ordered the killing. Author and commentator John Stepling joins us now from Android. Mr. Stepling, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on this attempted lawsuit against MBS.
It's hard to predict, how substantial the court will view the lawsuit, but you have to look at the fact that everybody knows bin Salman ordered Khashoggi to be executed in Turkey, in Istanbul, at the Saudi consulate, and dismembered. He's alleged to have a private mercenary team nicknamed the Tiger Squad. That's who was stopped trying to enter Canada. They were stopped with forensic tools in their luggage, I guess, because they might want to perform an autopsy while at the Hilton. Who knows? It's become almost comical because bin Salman is so out of control, so without a sense of proportion or I don't know. His executions have doubled since he became the, as you put it, de facto ruler. He's officially the next in line, but he really conducts all the business and policy of the monarchy. There was a charm offensive by bin Salman when he first, after the sort of soft coup at the palace, which a lot of this still stems from. The lawsuit is about a former intelligence agent of the monarchy that fell out of favor, but there was a charm offensive. The New York Times did several puff pieces. Tom Friedman did a well-known puff piece, and none of it has stuck. I mean, bin Salman is simply too dislikable a character, too psychotic, really, certainly sociopathic, for any of these charm offensive and marketing campaigns, the illusion of reform, all of this. None of it is really true. The repercussions for criticizing the monarchy, in particular criticizing bin Salman, are more severe than ever. Things like the execution of Khashoggi in Istanbul speaks to this, is testimony to this. And there was an intercepted, I think, email from bin Salman, but I could be wrong, maybe it was 12, in which he threatened the former intelligence agent that is in Canada and said, most surely we will reach you. So in spite of the charm offensives and the U.S., you know, sort of protecting the Saudis, protecting their image because they buy so many weapons from the U.S., they're the number one purchaser of armaments from the United States. And now there's secret meetings, in quotation marks, secret meetings between Netanyahu and Bin Salman that Mike Pompeo attended. In spite of all of this, the global perception of Bin Salman is as a murderous sociopath. And that's really what he is. And at some point, these kind of policies, no matter how protected he is and no matter how much oil you have, at some point, he becomes diplomatically a global embarrassment. And he's perilously close to that moment right now.
All right. Thanks to our author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Android. Elsewhere, Iran and Afghanistan have officially inaugurated the first railway between the two countries during a ceremony attended virtually by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani. Over 190-kilometer-long Khaf-Herat Railway connects Iran's eastern city of Khaf to Afghanistan's western city of Ghorian. It's part of the Iran-Afghan rail corridor and is expected to help boost trade between the two countries and beyond. Rouhani and Ghani hailed the inauguration of the railway, expressing hope that it will help boost the relations between the two countries.
We are witnessing this major inauguration on the two presidents' orders and through virtual space. I am sure today will go down in history of the two nations as a historic day.
The completion of such an important project, despite the coronavirus pandemic, is clearly indicative of the two nations' will.
The Afghan president also said the railway will be a key step toward Iran and Afghanistan's economic developments. The construction of the Khaf-Herat line began in 2007. It's part of a much bigger east-west railway project, which will connect China to Europe via Iran and Afghanistan. Our correspondent Houman Abedi says Iran-Afghanistan railway can have a pivotal role in strengthening ties between the two countries.
Well, this project is a very huge project because it is part of Iran's efforts to expand its rail network. Within the past years, Iran has expanded its rail network in five projects, and right now this is the sixth one. This project, which links Iran to Afghanistan, it stretches for about, when it is completed, it is about 225 kilometers, but right now three first phases of this project is going to be launched. 78 kilometers of this railway is in Iran's territory, and 62 kilometers of the railway, the remaining part, right now is in Afghanistan. But after its full completion, it will be about 225 kilometers. About the significance of this project, I can tell you, it can have a pivotal role in strengthening the ties between the two nations. Every year this railway can have about 6 million tons of goods transported.
Elsewhere, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the Islamic Republic is ready for the return of the U.S. to the 2015 nuclear deal.
We are ready for the return of the U.S. to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action so that Washington can earn its last privilege. However, the U.S. should implement its commitments in order to earn the privilege of being part of the JCPOA. I'm not saying this is impossible, but the U.S. should not be the one to put forward conditions. I'm not pessimistic about the future. Why? Not because of trusting the U.S., but because of the failure of its maximum pressure campaign.
Zadi said, however, that Iran's missile program is non-negotiable and conditioning this to the U.S.'s return to the JCPOA is out of question. He described the nuclear agreement as a great achievement for Iran. The top diplomat said the deal eliminated the security threat to Iran and helped end 6 U.N. Security Council resolutions against the country. U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. President-elect Joe Biden's national security advisor has said the incoming U.S. administration will rejoin the nuclear pact and, quote, force Tehran to comply with the terms of the original agreement. Jake Sullivan said this means lifting sanctions and follow-on negotiation on broader issues. Political analyst John Bosnich says the U.S. should first comply with its obligations under the nuclear deal, and then Iran can assess if Washington is a reliable partner to move forward with.
We have to do a little bit of a history lesson here. Iran, as Persia, was an international world power. Iran has now become a relatively benign regional power. There has been no war with Iran since the Americans pushed Iraq into the war with Iran. We have a situation now where Iran has attempted to maintain its sovereignty, which every state has the right to do, to guarantee its compliance with a deal which it signed and attempted to abide by with the United States. It was not Iran which withdrew from the deal with the United States, it was the USA. So the USA first has to undo its error. When it undoes its error, then Iran can make an assessment of whether the United States is a reliable partner to move forward with.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says the bloc and Britain are far apart on Brexit trade deal, as Downing Street says very large gaps still remain. The remarks came after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson met von der Leyen in Brussels to break an impasse over a post-Brexit trade deal. The British government said the two sides agreed to decide by Sunday whether their negotiations are worth continuing. Earlier, Johnson said no British leader could accept the current demands of the European Union. Britain formally left the bloc in January. The UK has since been in a transition period, during which it remains in the EU single market. The transition period ends on December the 31st. Jerome Hughes says British people are worried about the future of the country after Brexit.
A lot of people scratching their heads. They're wondering what actually do they really think this can achieve, especially critics of Boris Johnson. They're saying, well, you know, if this is how you can actually get a deal by having face-to-face high-level talks, well, why haven't you done it sooner? Why haven't you been in Brussels more often? A lot of people are saying as well he'd have been much better off perhaps going as a guest to the tomorrow, Thursday, and also Friday to the EU Leaders Summit here in Brussels, so he can actually speak to more of the sort of the key players in the European Union, maybe Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, you know, and so on, and maybe progress things that way. But so people are just wondering what actually will this achieve. And also following earlier today, Wednesday, following his speech in the British House of Commons, Boris Johnson, when he was talking about the type of language that he was using has actually encouraged people like Sinn Féin, the main opposition party in the Republic of Ireland, which is sort of a key player in terms of Irish politics, saying that it's looking now more and more likely that we're not going to get a deal because of the type of language Johnson was using. He was once again saying that, we will prosper mightily with or without a deal in the UK. And he also outlined some of the issues there. He said it would be the only country in the world that wouldn't have sovereignty over its fishing waters and so on.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said he would discuss strained U.S. relations with the next American president, playing down the possibility of sanctions over Turkey's purchase of Russian missile defense systems. Rasha Sagam reports.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The United States has reported more than 3,000 coronavirus fatalities, the highest daily death toll since the pandemic began. The Johns Hopkins University data show the number of infections also rose by over 220,000. The United States, being the world's worst hit country, has so far recorded more than 289,000 deaths and over 15.3 million cases. Elsewhere in the Americas region, Brazil registered more than 800 deaths and over 53,000 cases, its highest number of infections since mid-August. The Latin American nation has more than 6.7 million infections and nearly 179,000 deaths. Several human rights groups have warned that poor countries are set to miss out on COVID-19 vaccines amid a rush by richer nations to hoard them.
The People's Vaccine Alliance, of which Oxfam is a member, have looked at all the vaccine contracts that are on the table across the globe. And we've found that unless urgent action is taken by pharmaceutical corporations and rich country governments, 9 out of 10 people in poor countries are not going to receive a vaccine next year and possibly for years to come.
The alliance, which also includes Amnesty International and Global Justice, now said rich countries have bought enough COVID-19 vaccine doses for their populations 3 times over. Campaigners noted that wealthy nations have bought up to 53% of vaccines so far, while they comprise of only 14% of the global population. Rights groups called on governments and pharmaceutical industries to make sure vaccines are available and accessible to all. On Tuesday, the UK became the first Western country to start distributing a COVID-19 vaccine to its population.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution. Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all. Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population 5 times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst, inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity, but also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
a diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The European Union is Britain's biggest trading partner, accounting for 47% of its trade in 2019. It had a trade deficit of £79 billion, or $106 billion, with the European Union, a surplus of £18 billion in services, outweighed by a deficit of £97 billion in goods. Even with a Brexit trade deal, Britain's reasonable worst-case scenario is that 7,000 trucks bound for the continent could stack up in the southern English county of Kent. Britain's Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, has forecast a no-trade deal would wipe an extra 2% off British economic output in 2021, whilst driving up inflation, driving up unemployment and public borrowing. Britain's Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, said tariffs under World Trade Organization rules and border disruptions would hit parts of the economy, such as manufacturing, that were emerging relatively unscathed from the COVID-19 pandemic. The long-term hit could be costly for both Britain and the 27 remaining EU members. Germany, Europe's biggest economy, is Britain's biggest EU trading partner. The shock would be felt unevenly across the continental Europe, with those likely to be hit worst, including Ireland, the Netherlands, Belgium, France, Luxembourg, Malta, and Poland. The Haller Institute for Economic Research has forecast that European Union companies exporting to Britain could lose more than 700,000 jobs if no trade deal is agreed. We have prepared an article for you written jointly by Guy Falconbridge and John Chalmers. The piece is titled, The Potential Impact of Brexit Without a Trade Deal. The article has been taken from the website of the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more of Guy Falconbridge and John Chalmers' article. Britain and European Union sought on Sunday, 6th of December, to strike an elusive trade deal, with failure likely to end with trade in chaos, markets tumbling and a huge economic price to pay. Here are some of the potential pressure points of a no-trade deal after 5 years of Brexit crisis. Sterling. According to major foreign exchange traders, investors and banks have predicted that a deal will eventually be done, so a no deal would hit the sterling. The shock referendum result on 24th of June 2016 sent the pound down 8% against the US dollar, its biggest one-day fall since the era of free-floating exchange rates began in the 1970s. That was nearly double the 4.3% drop on 16th of September 1992, when financier George Soros broke the Bank of England after its bets against the pound were instrumental in the currency's exit from the European exchange rate mechanism. Trade. Overnight, Britain would lose zero tariff and zero quota access to the European single market of 450 million consumers. Britain would default to World Trade Organization terms in its trade with the 27-state bloc, making it, in effect, as distant to its biggest trading partner as Australia. Britain would impose its new UK global tariff on European Union imports, whilst the European Union would impose its common external tariff on British imports. Non-tariff barriers could hinder trade, with prices predicted to rise for consumers and for businesses. Borders risk disruption, especially the main crossing points, with shortages of certain goods possible, as Britain imports 60% of its fresh food. Any disruption will be felt most keenly by sectors that rely on just-in-time supply chains, including autos, food and drinks. Other sectors likely to be affected will include textiles, pharmaceuticals and chemical and petroleum products. The European Union is Britain's biggest trading partner, accounting for 47% of its trade in 2019. It had a trade deficit of £79 billion, or $106 billion, with the European Union, a surplus of £18 billion in services, outweighed by a deficit of £97 billion in goods. Even with a deal, Britain's reasonable worst-case scenario is that 7,000 trucks bound for the European continent could stack up in the southern English county of Kent. The economy. Britain's Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, has forecast a no-trade deal would wipe an extra 2% off British economic output in 2021, whilst driving up inflation, driving up unemployment and public borrowing. The Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, said tariffs under World Trade Organization rules and border disruptions would hit parts of the economy, such as the manufacturing sector, that were emerging relatively unscathed from the COVID-19 pandemic. The long-term hit could be costly for both Britain and the 27 remaining EU member states. Germany, Europe's biggest economy, is Britain's biggest EU trading partner. The shock would be felt unevenly across continental Europe, with those likely to be hit worse include Ireland, the Netherlands, Belgium, France, Luxembourg, Malta, and Poland. The Halle Institute of Economic Research has forecast that European Union companies exporting to Britain could lose more than 700,000 jobs if no trade deal is agreed. Northern Ireland. Both sides want to avoid a hard border between the United Kingdom's Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in the European Union. Implementing the Northern Ireland Protocol of the 2020 Brexit Treaty will be complicated without a trade agreement. Under the treaty, Northern Ireland remains in effect in the EU's single market for goods aligned to its customs rules after 31st of December, unlike the rest of the United Kingdom. Exactly how checks, regulations and paperwork will work between Britain and Northern Ireland is not yet clear. But without a trade deal, the divide between Britain and Northern Ireland would become more distinct. Brexit, without a trade deal, could allow Northern Ireland to become a backdoor into the EU's single market, thus raising the spectre of a hard border on the island of Ireland for the first time since the 1998 peace deal. The 1998 Good Friday Agreement brought an end to three decades of sectarian violence between mainly Protestant Unionists, who favoured continued British rule in Northern Ireland, and the mainly Catholic Irish Nationalists, who want a united Ireland. Acrimony. Both sides would likely blame each other for any chaos after a no-deal exit, and Europe would be split just as it faces the challenges of China's rise, Russia's self-reliance, and the continuing fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. Such a failure could shake the bloc that was created to bind the ruined nations of Europe into a global power after the Second World War. The European Union would lose one of Europe's leading military and intelligence powers, its second largest economy, and the only financial capital to rival New York. Britain would be alone, left far more dependent on its alliance with the United States. Britain is also pushing ahead with legislation known as the Internal Market Bill that would allow it to break parts of the 2020 Brexit Treaty relating to Northern Ireland, making it unclear how far it would implement the divorce deal. The City of London. London, the world's international financial capital, is largely ready for Brexit, as a trade deal was never going to cover Britain's most globally competitive industry. While most banks and investors have found ways to navigate Britain's departure from Europe, the long-term impact of an acrimonious Brexit would be unpredictable, and the European Union would likely try to grab more market share from the City of London. London is the centre of the world's $6.6 trillion a day foreign currency markets, accounting for 43% of global turnover. Its nearest European Union competitor, Paris, accounts for about 2%. The British capital is also the global centre for euro trading, a potential headache for the European Central Bank, the ECB.
Debate.
A judge in the U.S. has ordered the U.S.'s intelligence agencies to acknowledge that they possess a tape recording of the 2018 assassination of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The judge also instructed the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, an office of the Director of the National Intelligence, to explain why they are withholding the tape and a CIA report on the gruesome killing. In this debate, we will ask why these agencies are withholding the tape and why it would take this long for this judge to make this move. Also look at the timing of this announcement. Do stay with us for this debate. Let's bring in our guest to discuss this. Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, joins us from Washington, D.C. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Said Mohsen Abbas, date of the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, October 2nd of 2018. Today's date, December 9, more than 2 years after the date of the assassination. Why do you think it would take this long for this announcement to be made and for this move to be made, which would prompt them to make, obviously, an announcement that should have been made when the assassination took place and when they got that information?
Well, I think straight away, the American intelligence, first of all, knew perfectly well what was going on. They would have been perfectly aware that Jamal Khashoggi was on the target list, and indeed they would have been aware of his movements. And they obviously subsequently have engaged in a cover-up of absolutely outrageous proportions. Right from the outset of when the news was released, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo hand-delivered a plan to the Saudi royal families, helped the crown prince get away literally with murder. You know, he was engaged from a very early stage in damage limitation. You know, Middle East Eye and various other well-known, if you like, established journals, etc., and broadsheets across the American corporate media network themselves have been pointing fingers, and it's been an open discussion, really, that Pompeo devised this plot to help shield Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman
from the fallout following the highly publicized murder. Pompeo discussed the plan with Saudi Arabia's king during a visit to the country's capital soon after, a couple of weeks after, I think, it happened. And they methodically went through this process of plausible deniability, and they worked out this thing. They were actually quite blatant about it. And it's rooted in one fundamental thing. The US is tied to Saudi Arabia at the hip. The dollar, the US dollar, has floated on the back of Saudi oil control of prices, etc. It's also floated the US arms industry, because Saudi Arabia has bought $13 billion worth of arms for its war on Yemen, which again is totally backed and instigated, supported by their American allies. And these two factors, the arms industry, the oil resources that the Americans desperately need to fill their debt holes in their own economy, necessitated that Donald Trump would do and say whatever was necessary to cover up the incompetence of the out-murder of Khashoggi by the Saudi establishment.
Okay, Michael Springman, we're looking at what the judge has instructed the two of the most important agencies in the U.S. to do, the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, to explain why they're withholding the tape and a CIA report also. I mean, aside from the fact that these agencies are supposed to uphold justice and the rule of law, what has withheld them from releasing this information, which is the tape and the report, and why is it that they have not released it even up to this point?
Well, there's a lot of reasons behind this. There are 9 exemptions to the Freedom of Information Act on which this George Soros Open Society initiative is filed. And you can start off with 1, national security, and then you can get into internal agency practices, which is probably a euphemism in this case for intelligence sources and methods, none of which might be disclosed. You can get the exemption for law enforcement operations and records and things like this. And then there's the exemption for privacy. You invade someone's privacy by disclosing some of this information. And of course, you've got most of the federal judges who have spent time in the Justice Department and learned the ways and means of withholding information, which is what justice does in many cases, especially in lawsuits dealing with the Freedom of Information Act. So I think that what they've done really is simply order the agencies and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence to give them an index, a Vaughn index, of what they're withholding and why. And then they go on from there. And of course, the Vaughn index is not necessarily disclosed to the general public. So we can foresee a fair amount of wrangling about what's there, what you're withholding, and why you're withholding it. Of course, in my case, when I tried to find out why I was fired by the State Department, my Freedom of Information Act lawsuit was sealed as a threat to national security. So the judges can do as they please, and they can take their time on this.
Okay. Well, the last part I'd like to talk to you about, but obviously that should be left for another debate, I think. So we're going to leave that one there. Simo Sarabas, it was very interesting, if you recall, and I'm sure you remember, when the CIA did actually conclude that the Saudi Crown Prince had been responsible for the killing. So then you would think that, they must have had some information. I'm wondering if this tape was part of that. But then is where it kind of stopped in terms of having something concrete or tangible when you have the Central Intelligence Agency coming out with that statement. Do you think that the stoppage happened in the form of the U.S. President Donald Trump?
I think Donald Trump was directly involved. There was a very quick response from the CIA after the murder, and they had concluded in a high confidence assessment that the Crown Prince personally ordered the murder of the journalists. Now, the relationship of Donald Trump and the Crown Prince is well known, and the Trump administration saw the Crown Prince as a pivotal part of their policy in the Middle East. They certainly weren't going to jeopardize his stability there, and they went all out to protect him. I mean, even before the CIA's conclusion was made public, evidence released by the Turkish officials strongly suggested that the Saudi Crown Prince had a hand in Khashoggi's brutal murder. That evidence was starting to emerge right around the time Pompeo was visiting Saudi Arabia in those initial couple of weeks of the cover-up. He met the Crown Prince at that time, and after the visit, Pompeo urged patience. He urged patience and said that administration had pledged to give the Saudi regime more time to produce an explanation regarding Khashoggi's killing. Now, compare that to the way that the Americans operate, for instance, with the Islamic Republic of Iran, or those people who don't play ball with them around the world. They don't need any excuse. They'll go off and commit extrajudicial murders and killings themselves. So let's not pick on the Saudis alone in this situation. Donald Trump has form in extrajudicial killing himself. General Soleimani being the obvious example. Their partners Israel just done it again in Iran with Mr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, I think, from the nuclear industry. So look, this is just normal practice, and for Trump to weigh in and back up his crucial partner is no surprise, and they carried that on right through their administration, right to the very last moment, because there are obviously going to be things that are going to come out which damn and indict the whole system and the corrupt mechanism by which the American state basically operates its kind of rogue foreign policies. That's not going to stop anytime soon, but absolutely clear that Khashoggi outraged the whole world, yet look what's happened. They've managed to do a public relations hatchet job in terms of covering it up. You don't hear either their partners in Europe moaning or groaning about this, yet again, when it comes to the likes of the Islamic Republic of Iran or Hezbollah or people who are obviously fighting for their own independence in that region, the European Union, all of this gang of, if you like, what I call Anglo-Zionist, if you like, movement, are there to pick on that individual. Yet Saudi Arabia, he gets given nuclear information, nobody complains. That's what the Americans are doing. American corporate companies are now bolstering Saudi Arabia up as a potential nuclear power in that region. They get no pullback on the war in Yemen, as I said. They're allowed to operate with the likes, in producing the likes of ISIS and Al-Qaeda to unleash on West Asia. This is a carte blanche license, like the Zionist regime, that the Americans allow their partners.
Well, Michael Springman, let's look at that famous interview that Donald Trump had with the veteran journalist Bob Woodward. I don't know if you recall that that interview, but this was just recent, maybe a couple months at this point. But in that interview, Donald Trump said that he protected Prince Salman from Congress, boasting, and his quote, what I'm going to quote is what he said. He said, "I saved his," well, I can't use the word that he used, but you can imagine what he did say. So, first of all, according to U.S. law, wouldn't that make Trump guilty if he knew that the Saudi Crown Prince had actually ordered this killing? Because according to Penal Code Section 31, titled Aiding and Abetting a Crime, if you help conceal a crime, in so many words, then you're also guilty of it, not guilty of the crime, but you're guilty under the rule of law.
Well, yes, indeed, it would be, except that this is always ignored. Look at Barack Obama when he assassinated Anwar al-Awlaki and his son in Yemen by drone strike without any kind of judicial proceedings whatsoever. The president has carte blanche to do as he pleases, even though he is as chief executive, charged with seeing that the laws of the United States are carefully obeyed. So I think it's basically the Americans are want to cultivate their relationship with Saudi Arabia. When I was there 20 years ago, 30 years ago now, one of the goals of the U.S. mission was to ensure that we get plenty of oil from the Saudis, and that was done in such a way as to never offend the Saudis in any way whatsoever. The Saudis were engaged in deals with individuals to sell drugs and alcohol, and then raid the parties at which the drugs and alcohol were consumed. and you couldn't report this to the American the Americans living in our consular district, because that would offend the Saudis. And this is, you know, not new policy. It's been going on for all the time the United States has been involved with Saudi Arabia since the 1930s.
Well, Sir Mohsen Abbas, right now, however, it's a new day. You have the current U.S. President Donald Trump perhaps to be on his way out. And you have a new administration, once confirmed, and if confirmed, headed by President-elect Joe Biden. You have Saudi Arabia and its oil exports to the U.S. to slump to one of its lowest points. So that kind of leaves the Saudi crown prince, at least on this issue, not to have someone who may support him at this point. We know how the president-elect feels about this, obviously very to have been very angered about what Saudi Arabia has done. Do you think the timing of this piece of news is somewhat coinciding, again, once confirmed, with the incoming U.S. administration headed by Biden?
Well, it is a fact that Biden will subtly shift some of his emphasis. He'll, I think, try to look like he's a little bit harsher with Saudi Arabia. He'll try and give his allies some sort of security that they are willing to abide by some international rule of law. But I don't think it'll be anything substantial. I think deep down, nothing will change. And the Biden administration would also engage in perhaps not such an overt cover-up, but they certainly won't pursue the Saudi establishment in any way, shape or form, in my opinion. I mean, the fact was that it was such a blatant act of covering up that Trump himself offered a stinging indictment of the Saudi effort to silence that dissident journalist, calling the series of events that led to the Khashoggi's death the worst cover-up ever. But he says the cover-up was one of the worst in the history of cover-ups. That was what Trump said from the Oval Office. And he said it's very simple, and he called the whole episode a total fiasco. So not only did he do the cover-up of the cover-up, he actually was more or less boasting about this fact. I mean, I don't think Biden will be as blatant and as outrageous as this. And I think this is what the Trump regime, in terms of foreign policy, has done. It's really, in many ways, helped the ordinary public to really see the U.S. Administration and foreign policy for what it is. But not for one moment can you imagine that Hillary Clinton or the likes of Biden or Obama were very much different. Again, Obama launched more wars in his period and has a greater track record of killing people in West Asia and the Middle East, and was equally supportive of relations with Saudi Arabia as Donald Trump. Donald Trump simply did it absolutely, overtly and in your face. And that, I don't think, is now going to change a great deal. They are desperate, the Americans, to keep whatever cash is left within the oil revenues of Saudi Arabia. They want that all to ultimately come into American coffers, whether it comes through just bonds that the Saudis invest in, whether it comes through oil revenue that goes that way, or whether it comes through any other means. Real estate, for instance, the Saudis have $3 trillion of investments in American real estate. So you can see the relationship is primarily about money, but it's also geopolitical, strategically important at the moment, because the clash with the resistance axis, the Islamic Republic of Iran, necessitates that Saudi Arabia is used as a base by the Israelis, by the Americans, in their ongoing, war of, if you like, terror on the Islamic Republic in that region.
Well, let's look at the consequences of this very special relationship, if we can, and how it may affect different arenas, Michael Springman. I mean, first of all, the Saudi Crown Prince, he hasn't been humbled by this. We're looking at the most eye-opening incident in which a lawsuit was filed in the U.S. court by Saad al-Jabri, who has claimed that there was an assassination attempt that took place in Canada, where he has fled 3 years ago. He says Mohammed bin Salman wanted him dead because he knew too much. So you have that repercussion. And then you have how Saudi Arabia is still emboldened by the Saudi war, as our guest there in London said. And even looking at other things that Saudi Arabia has done in terms of silencing dissent within the kingdom. And the list could go on and on in terms of other violations that Saudi Arabia commits. So doesn't the U.S. see that this is going to lead to consequential incidents for Saudi Arabia to be involved in without looking back?
Oh, it does, but it certainly doesn't care. The U.S. government knows perfectly well the Saudis have been after dissidents around the world. I was once on Al-Mayadeen talking with a Saudi prince exiled in Germany. The Saudis have kidnapped people from Europe and brought them back to Saudi Arabia, and they disappeared them. The Americans know it. The Americans don't care. The press doesn't do much about it. They focus on Khashoggi, but they do very little about the other people, about Lujain al-Haflul and other dissidents that have been kidnapped from the Emirates and other countries and brought to so-called Saudi justice in the kingdom, and then jailed. So it's not going to have much of a change until and unless some people put the feet of the American government to the fire. And, of course, the national news media won't do it because they're too dependent on government sources and too dependent on organizations like these huge defense contractors for advertising revenue. So they're going to huff and puff and expect it to blow over as it eventually will.
Okay. My final question to you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. You know, when we take a look at the gruesome assassination and the way that it took place in terms of the dismemberment and perhaps using acid, et cetera, you have this cover-up that's happened. Okay, we know that. The bigger question here maybe should be asked about this relationship and whether there's a possibility that agencies like the CIA, like the national intelligence agencies in the U.S. actually help cover up the 9/11 attacks in terms of covering Saudi Arabia and its involvement. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. The bottom line is one would have to be absolutely naive to the most ridiculous proportions not to imagine that the covert deep state intelligence of MI6, CIA, Mossad was incapable of tracking what Saudis were up to. Being such a key ally, being such a key source of revenue and such an important partner, who really imagines that the CIA, etc., wouldn't have their paws all over Saudi intelligence and their operatives? The fact is they know everything that moves within Salman's own bedroom, I would imagine. And following Jamal Khashoggi's killing, on the point of what people have reported, other victims have reported the Saudi regime's attempted to lure them into their embassies even after Khashoggi was killed. It's that ridiculous. The Tiger Squad, the death squad that's named as the squad that actually assassinated even Khashoggi, again is implicated in this. You know, exiled Saudi activist Omar Abdulaziz vouches for this. An opposition Saudi scholar, Abdullah Al-Oud, son of Salman Al-Oud, who's actually in prison amongst 30 to 40,000 other political prisoners of conscience held by Saudi Arabia without any real due process or law. All of these people have been, of course, now putting in these claims that this Saudi intelligence goes around killing everybody. So, yes, I would say the CIA, Mossad, etc., are hand in glove with these efforts.
Thank you very much for that, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. And thank you, Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat to Saudi Arabia, spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitaev, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-Aliyyi al-Azim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin la siyama baqiyatillah fil arabin ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarih. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafs ammare, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers, of the Rusul, who were given the book and Mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide